This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. The film, Kanthura, One Day of Nakba, showing this Thursday at Cinema Nova. I'll be speaking with the grandson of one of the survivors of the massacre and ethnic cleansing of this and other villages in May 1948 in Palestine, Muriad Ali. Dr. Alison Brynoska with the great news that fellow journalist Mary Kostakidis, who is being hounded by the Jewish lobby here in Australia, has been awarded a prestigious award in the United States for her fearless journalism, but they're still hounding her here in Australia. Speaking with the Reverend Sadie Stone from the US, denied entry to the Philippines, yet another human rights advisor, barred from speaking to Filipinas about the abuses there. And Dr. Tim Anderson, back from Iran and Cuba. Today he'll be speaking about his time in Iran and next week, Cuba. John Quirapel, author, historian, theologian, and social commentator with a bit of nostalgia for the 70s and 80s, but nevertheless hope for this generation of young people. So that's it for Tuesday Home Time. I hope you can stay tuned for Common Affairs in the next 2 hours. This Thursday, the 19th of June, Cinema Nova is screening Kanthura, a film by Alon Swartz. One Day of Nakba, a hidden history, a silenced truth, an event organised by Free Palestine Melbourne. Today I'm speaking with a Palestinian with a personal connection to Kanthura, a village where a massacre took place on the 22nd and the 23rd of May 1948, when Palestinian villagers were massacred by Israel's Haganah, namely Alex and Roni Brigade. His name is Muriad Ali, and he's currently an organiser with Free Palestine Melbourne. Muriad, could we first establish the location of the village of Kanthura prior to 1947-48?
Kanthura village, located south of Haifa in Palestine. Kanthura population was about 1,000 to 2,000 people in 1948 before the ethnic cleansing and massacre happened.
And what did people do there? What was their livelihood?
The majority of the people of Kanthura used to work as fishermen and in farms as farmers. Also, some of them work in public service, like tour guards, teachers, and other professions.
And when you say fishermen, were probably doing the same thing that they've been doing for hundreds of years.
Absolutely, because they are the indigenous people of that land. And the most of the Kanthura people descended from the Canaanite, which is the indigenous people or the indigenous landowners of the land of Palestine. Not surprisingly that Dur, the ancient civilization, located very close to Kanthura village.
Tell me about your family's connection to Kanthura.
My grandfather and my grandmother was born in Kanthura, and my grandmother was ethnically cleansed from Kanthura in 1948. She was a widow. Her husband, my grandfather, was killed by a British soldier who was a shore guard. He killed while he's on a duty. And she have to take a journey to another country after she'd been ethnically cleansed with her 8 children. That's what happened to her, as many other people from Kanthura at that night.
Tell me what you mean by ethnically cleansed in relationship to your grandmother and the other villagers.
Ethnically cleansed means that forcibly being removed from your village, forcibly taken and separated from your people and pushed outside of your hometown. So at that night in 1948, 23rd of May, the Alexandroni Brigade, the Israeli IOF, came to the village, attacked the village, separated men and the women, because of my uncle was 18 years old that time, so he's been separated from his mother and his siblings, and he been jailed. My grandmother has to actually flee with the rest of her kids, leaving her oldest son detained, and then she flee to another village, then to the West Bank, and then she ended up in Iraq.
Just before her time in Iraq, what happened to her oldest son?
Her other son been released months later, and she has to go back and looking for him. So she found him and bring him back to join the family in Iraq.
Well, that wouldn't have been easy.
Not easy, of course, because that was like very hard for her to leave some children in Iraq and go back to find or ask about her son in the West Bank, because she cannot reach her village anymore, the 48 areas, and because he was like following where the refugee went, refugee camps, or where actually they settled in the West Bank before they've been ethnically cleansed to another country. So she has to go and ask there until she found him, and then he joined their family.
And what happened to the other men and young men in the village?
At that night, about 250 innocent Palestinians from Tantura being killed. They've been buried in a mass grave. They've been asked to dig their own grave, and then the soldier buried them. And that what actually been documented, and the testimonies of the ex-IOF soldiers clearly actually mentioned that in their testimonies. Also, that very much matching the Palestinian narrative.
And that wouldn't have been an unusual occurrence with the other villages in the region. Were there a lot of villages in the region?
There is about 530 Palestinian villages being ethnically cleansed in 1948. There are major massacres happening not only in Tantura, but in Deir Yassin, Beled El-Sheikh, and other villages. So Tantura not unique, but Tantura massacre was one of the famous massacre that actually happened in 1948.
Famous or infamous?
One of the recognized and significant massacre that happened in 1948.
Why was that?
Why is that? Because of the scale of the killing, the scale of the attack on that civilian population of Tantura, and the importance of the location of Tantura that the Zionists wanted to be conquered and occupied.
And how did the soldiers enter the village, and what did they actually do?
As they enter the village, they start shooting about any innocent people or anyone moving in the village, and then house by house, gathering people in the middle of the village. So they gathered them on the beach, separated the men and the women, and then they took men over 18 years old. They took some of them. They suspect they are actually could resist. And then they kill them. Before they kill them, they ask them to dig their own graves. Some of them resisted, they've been killed at the spot. Some of them resisted, their female family members raped, and then they've been killed at the spot as well when they resist that. It's been a very, very bad and tragic massacre.
There would have also been farm animals there as well.
Oh yes, of course, because those people, the Panturas people used to farm their own land. They used to have their own cattle and so on.
Now, you say your grandmother ended up in Iraq. That's a fair way from Gaza, where you're talking about. What was that journey for her? Could you explain it in more detail?
The journey was not an easy journey because basically she have, after the massacre that day, she has to go to another village where she think that she could be safe. And that village or town called Al-Frabiz next to Tantura. And the Zionists still follow everyone who flee from Tantura to that area and ask them also to flee away from the whole area. And she has to go again to the West Bank. And the West Bank was the Iraqi army trying to defend the people of the West Bank from the Zionist attack. And then because there was no international humanitarian organization that time looking after refugees or displaced people, so she has been taken by with other refugees on an army truck to Iraq, and she ended up in Iraq. In Iraq, she have to suffer and to embark a very long journey of raising her children. She studied to be a midwife, and then she started working and raised her children in Iraq until they grow up, get married, and have a second generation of Nakba.
How old were the children when they left?
My oldest uncle was 18 years old, who'd been detained. Then next one was about 16. My father was about 13 years old.
How did your grandmother keep in touch with any of her other relatives? I imagine that would have been difficult too.
It's so difficult because she have only sister as well, at that time, and her sister flee with her to the West Bank. But when the army truck comes, her sister ended up in a truck going to Syria, not to Iraq, and my grandmother ended up in a truck going to Baghdad, and the two only sister has been separated since then.
The refugees ended up in many of those countries in the Middle East, from Jordan to Lebanon to Syria to Iraq. What do you know about their fate? Do you have any knowledge of what happened to them?
The refugees, mainly from Haifa or from Tantura, separated across different countries surrounding Palestine, like Jordan, Syria, Iraq. The majority of the people of Tantura ended up in Syria. They built a community there with the refugee community. But mainly in Iraq, the Palestinian refugee came from Haifa.
Do you remember the first time you were told about the massacre?
I've been told from the massacre since I'm very young, by my father and my grandmother. And we grow up as Palestinian refugees, carrying the pain and consequences of the Nakba in our life. Growing up, with the advanced media and technology, social media, we learn a lot about what happened from the Zionists to our people. And until now, every day we learn more and more. And if you can see what happened in the last 2 years to Gaza, you can imagine what happened to the people of Tantura in 1948, where no media, no advanced media, no social media, and no actually accountability or human rights organization that actually can document their atrocities.
What did your father witness as a 13-year-old?
He witnessed the massacred. He witnessed the detention of his oldest brother. He witnessed the killing of his father by the British soldier. Not the actual killing, but he witnessed when they bring his father and told them he been killed by a British soldier. And he witnessed all the agony, and he impacted the whole journey of ethnic cleansing and from Tantura to Baghdad.
I'd imagine that's affected his whole life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was keen to raise us very well, to be educated, to be a good people, and to fight for the freedom of our Palestinian people and to raise awareness about what happened in Palestine.
Well, you were in Iraq with your family. What was the journey to Australia?
The journey to Australia was not an easy one. I used to work with a company, with an Australian company in Iraq. And then when the war started, I've been threatened. And then I moved to Dubai. In Dubai, I've been connected by the Australian embassy, telling me that because of the threat that you receive due to your work with the Australian, you can apply for special humanitarian visa. And I did, then I accepted, then ended up in Australia.
Can you expand on what the threat was and why?
The threat was because I was working with some Australian training company that train medics new in Iraq. I was a classroom interpreter with the Australian instructor. At the time of war and the sectarian war, anyone works with people who come to the country, foreign people or any foreign company, being threatened to be killed. And I have one of my close friends killed that time. And then I decided to leave Iraq to Dubai. And I worked 2 years in Dubai before I ended up in Australia.
What happened to the other members of your family, your other brothers and sisters, and your mother?
Later on, I could sponsor some of my family members because of the war, they flee to Syria as refugees, and I applied for them in 2011. They been accepted and came to Australia. My mother being sponsored by my brother, who used to work with me as well, and threatened and came to Australia as well. But he came with my mother because he was the only supporter for her, so she was included in with his application.
Did you have trouble settling here in Australia, or was it fairly easy?
Not really trouble. I managed to work. I managed to finish my master's degree in public health. I've been working for 15 years now with the Australian Red Cross Life of Blood. I also have built my own business.
What was it like for you on October the 7th, 2023?
Observing a genocide is not an easy thing. My humanity and my morality always pushing me to advocate for the freedom of my people, the right of my people to live in peace, the right of my people to live freely in their homeland without war, peacefully. They have the right to education, to health, to peace, as any other nation. So that's why I was working towards their freedom as much as I can.
What has it been like for you these last nearly 3 years now, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's it been like for you?
I cannot say I'm traumatized, but compared to the people there under bombardment, I go every Sunday where there is a rally and participate and try to organize as much as I can. Watching the news, educating myself about not just the Palestinian struggle, but other struggles. Educating myself about how to push my community to be supportive of a human right and against and to become anti-war.
What contact do you have now with Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and also in Lebanon?
I don't have direct contact with any in Gaza or the West Bank, but I have also friends there, but no direct contact. In Lebanon, I have some family members, but also they are not in the south, they are near Beirut, so they're okay, But anytime the situation in Lebanon could be escalated, and it's war everywhere in Lebanon at the moment.
Have you seen the film Tantura?
Yes, I seen the film. I met with the cast in Tantura in 2019 before the film produced. Tibikas is the hero of the film. And then I watched the film in 2022 here in Australia in special limited screening that we tried to do for our activists to learn about the film before we acknowledge it is proper for screening to other people, and it's not actually adopting the Zionist narrative. Also, I met the producer of the film here in Australia in 2023, I believe, and we discuss how he get the idea of doing the film and the testimonies he get and everything. So we discuss many things about the film, but the film very much matching the Palestinian narrative. There is a denial in the film about the massacre, of course, but it's obvious that the denial is not genuine.
Must be very difficult to sit in a studio or a theatre and watch what was your family's hometown, home village being destroyed, and your family, its
Absolutely.
ethnic
It, it
lens.
it brings a lot of memories of my grandmother talking about the village, talking about her daily life there, how beautiful it was, and talking about the beach and her dream to go back and swim in the beach in the water there, and brings the memories of my father talking about his school in the village and his life, his siblings, and with his friends. It was full of beautiful life at that time. Unfortunately, it's been taken, it's been massacred, and people ended up away, deprived from the freedom, deprived from the return, and deprived from even the right to claim their own home back.
What do you see as the importance of films such as this after so many years?
The importance of such film is documenting the atrocities, documenting what happened, the massacre, I mean, to raise awareness for those people who don't know about what happened in Palestine or about what happened in during the Nakba. And because we are fighting for justice, and justice cannot be achieved without visiting what happened and correct what has been done to the innocent people.
Well, in a sense, what we're seeing is history repeating itself, but this time the whole world is watching on.
The whole world is watching on, but there is no accountability. There is no stop to the killing. Every day now in Gaza, still people, innocent people, children getting killed, and no government doing anything about that, but giving green light to Israel to keep going, because if when they are not actually doing any accountability or stopping Israel or sanctioning Israel, Israel will keep doing the same thing, killing people and stealing Palestinian land.
The feeling that you would have that you are unable to change what's happening at home, and as you say, world leaders don't seem to care, but it must mean for you that your friends and your family with you are so important to keep life in some sense of stability for you.
Of course, yeah. We understand that the change is not easy to be achieved. However, we see people shifting from silence to speaking about what's happening. And we see the support for the Palestinian people, freedom, we've seen the support, I mean, on public level, not government level. Some government sympathize with the Palestinian people, of course, but still the decision makers not able to take a decision that significant could stop Israel from keep going with their genocide on the Palestinian people.
The trouble is, it's not just Palestinians now. I mean, I know in Lebanon it's Palestinian people, but it's not all. And Israel seems to be unstoppable at the moment.
Absolutely not. Israel will not stop until it feels the consequences happening. Lebanese people fought for their freedom as well in South Lebanon. Israel occupied part of South Lebanon for years now, since 1967, when the Lebanese people fighting back to get their land, being accused by terrorism worldwide. And to understand what happened in Lebanon, you cannot ignore the fact that the Lebanese people have the full right to fight for their land back and to claim the occupied territories from the Israeli occupation. And this is not being actually acknowledged by the international community, and always the opposite. Israel being supported to go to Lebanon, invade Lebanon, attack Lebanon, kill Lebanese people. Reason always say, okay, it's fighting Hezbollah, fighting terrorism in South Lebanon.
And it makes it all more important too, I believe, to have groups like Free Palestine Melbourne, APAN, and other advocacy groups to continue to push the government to take a stand.
Absolutely. The advocacy group here in Australia and the support for Palestine built since a long time and now growing very much. In the last year, few year, couple year, couple of years, we witness 100,000 of people joining the movement, and especially when we observe the big march on Harbour Bridge in Sydney. That was a significant moment for every Palestinian and every supporter of Palestine to see the support from the Australian people to the struggle of Palestinian people.
What would you like to say in the last few words?
I would say that as Palestinian, as supporter of Palestine, we will keep working hard to achieve peace, freedom, and justice for the Palestinian people.
Thank you, Muriat.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Muriat Ali, Palestinian now living in Melbourne, about a film which has been screened this Thursday at Cinema Nova, Tantura, the village where his grandmother was forced to flee the massacre on the night and day of 22nd, 23rd of May, 1948. The film is one day of Nakba, a hidden history, a silenced truth, and it's at Cinema Nova this Thursday, the 19th of June, and the time is 6:15 p.m.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
Speaking now with Alison Bronowski, academic, journalist, writer, former Australian public servant, and prominent in the group Australians for War Powers Reform. And Alison, we've got a couple of issues we want to talk about, but I want to start off on the good news story, and that is fellow journalist Mary Costakidis.
Lovely, as you say, to have a good news story for once. Now, Mary Costakidis, who all your listeners will know very well as a former SBS news producer, news presenter, who has fallen on very hard times lately because she's being pursued by the Australian Jewish lobby for having retweeted things that they didn't like, for goodness sake, ages ago, and has been defending herself at great expense and with huge anxiety and midnight oil in court, and it's still going on. And she is being, quite frankly, made an example of by people who want somebody prominent like her to be shown up as a cautionary tale for anybody who wants to criticise the government of Israel and its nefarious activities. Mary has at last been recognised for her courage and persistence by being given a Gary Webb Award. Now, who is Gary Webb, you may say? Gary Webb is a former American journalist who used to work for the Mercury, San Jose Mercury News. He was born in 1955, and he wrote a story for the San Jose News in 1996 called the Dark Alliance series on crack cocaine trade in Los Angeles, involving the anti-communist Contra rebels in Nicaragua, which everybody will remember as the Iran-Contra scandal. What happened was, as we all remember, that they created a trade in cocaine and used the profits for funds to fight the government in Nicaragua, and were backed in doing this by the CIA. And it was Gary Webb who broke this story in a series. The Mercury News claimed that it was oversimplified and criticized him for virtually their own journalist for having done that. He resigned the following year, 1997, and he became an investigator for the California State Legislature. Then, a few years later, 5 years later, he suddenly died by, quote, suicide. So Gary Webb has always had his face in the column of Consortium News. And if you look at Consortium News, you'll see that there he is, and the story that I've just garbled about him is there. And every year they have found somebody deserving of his memory for individuals showing extraordinary courage and persistence in investigative reporting, which is what they have now recognised Mary Costakidis for. So congratulations to Mary, and I hope that anybody who admires what she's been doing will get in touch with her and send a donation for her legal costs, which are enormous.
There was an award in Sydney at the weekend. Were you able to attend?
No, I wasn't, because I'm down on the south coast of New South Wales these days, and I wasn't able to be there on that day, but it was apparently a terrific event.
What will it mean? Will it be monetary, or will it be accolades? And I believe there are other Australians who have won the award as well.
Yes, of course, Julian Assange and John Pilger. If there are others, hooray for them too, but those are the ones that I knew about. And the Consortium News, I'm not too sure how wealthy an organisation it is, but it's an awfully good online source of news that I read every day, and they have some terrific articles by some of the best people around. At times like these, they certainly deserve as much readership as they can get.
Interested in an article you wrote about President Duterte of the Philippines, his trials coming up, and also linking that with President of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. Explain why you did this.
Well, actually, I linked three presidents together, President Maduro of Venezuela and ex-President Duterte of the Philippines and President Trump, because Duterte and Trump both have birthdays this month. And I think, is it today, our time, President Trump's birthday, 80, and the same age as Duterte, whose birthday is a little bit later this month. The difference between them is that Duterte is locked up in The Hague, in prison, facing charges of war crimes against his own people in Mindanao, in the Philippines. Many may think the day may come when Trump too is locked up for war crimes, but I suspect it will be quite a long time before that happens. But it's interesting that there are the two of them. Duterte, in a way, was like, he was elected 6 months before Trump's first election. And Duterte is like a pre-Trump model of Trump. He himself boasted about killing people he didn't like, about defying and pursuing journalists who wrote stories about him, which, though they were true, he found unflattering. And so there are all these things. Also, like to think of himself as a tough guy, you know, strong hero man, alpha male, I suppose you'd call him, or he would call himself. The fascinating thing is that this pre-Trump figure is now in jail. The real Trump figure has done things in attacking Venezuela that would certainly amount to war crimes if there were any sense of justice in the world, by sending the US Navy to attack ships that they claimed were carrying drugs from Venezuela, and maybe they were, but killing 200 odd people. By the way, there are about some three, I think, Australians on board the American submarine that did this. And it's just appalling that we have these dictatorial figures who face different scales of justice, it seems.
And the third one, Maduro, stuck in a detention centre jail in somewhere in the United States now, and his future is very uncertain.
Well, exactly. He and his wife, of course, were, as you might say, kidnapped by the US Air Force, who went in and took them from their house, transported them to the United States, where they are now. In fact, Maduro was before the courts just this last week, and I haven't found any reports about what took place there, but you can imagine that facing American justice in the age of Trump, he doesn't have very much of a chance of a fair hearing. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it links back, doesn't it, to what we were just saying about Julian Assange being on trial in Britain. Once they've made up their minds that you're guilty, it's damned hard to get you out of there. And it was very hard for Australia to get Julian back here, which was one of the high points, I have to say, of the Albanese government, that they managed eventually to do that.
And also a high point that they managed to get Duterte into The Hague.
That too. The fact that a number of countries supported that happening was a sort of a triumph in a way for international law, because, you know, people go on about there being no enforcement of international law, and quite often that is true. Nevertheless, Duterte was arrested, and by Philippine operations, because they were obliged to implement the findings of the international court, and they did so. It's the kind of thing that I would like to see more of in Australia. For instance, inviting to Australia President Herzog of Israel, who is complicit in the war crimes of his own country, including writing nasty things on bombs that are about to be dropped on Gaza, inviting him to Australia instead of asking whether, as a supporter of war crimes, he ought to be here at all.
And you'll be listening to Alison Brynoski, and we'll hear more of Alison on the program next week, talking about Mr. Albanese and Mr. Trump, and also what's happening in regard to the Chagos Islands.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
This June we'll be asking for your donations to support 3CR.
Your donation during Radiothon keeps the station radical and enables us to give voice to our community for another year.
All donations over $2 are tax deductible.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au. Show your support by donating this June.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Have a few children's picture books or footy boots that your kids have outgrown but want to find them a loving home? Well, drop them in at 3CR and put them in the Books and Boots bin. Books and Boots regularly sends pre-loved children's picture books and sports footwear to remote and regional First Nations communities and children across the country. Contact us at Books and Boots or go to the website www.booksandboots.org.au. We love a good book.
On the 12th of May, an uneventful plane trip from the US to the Philippines ended for Reverend Sadie Stone, a United Methodist pastor, a member of the Global Council of the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines, and a law student at the University of San Francisco School of Law, being barred entry at Ninoy Aquino International Airport in Manila. When I spoke with Sadie, I asked her first what she was told by officials at the airport as to the reason why she was being denied entry to the country.
I landed at the airport in Manila and I was going through immigration, as you do when you land. And as they took my passport and they at the immigration station, and as soon as they scanned it, the woman who was behind the desk, when she scanned my passport, something came up. I don't know what it was, but she was looking at the screen, and then she tapped the shoulder of the woman who was sitting next to her in the other station, and they both were looking at it together. And then without saying anything to me, she got up and she walked away. And at this point, other people are being processed very quickly, right? All the other stations, people are moving through very quickly. And so she walked away for maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes. And when she came back, she had a piece of paper with her. And again, she still hasn't said anything to me. And she's just writing on her paper. And then she gets up and she asks me to follow her. And so at that point, I follow her. She took me to a secondary immigration station. And that's when I saw the piece of paper she had said secondary immigration screening. So I was taken over to that area onto the side of immigration, where there was like 10 immigration personnel and probably like 5 or 6 computers. And at that point, they did finally ask me, they asked if I had ever been to the Philippines before. And I said yes. And then they went back to their computers and their writing. And then they asked me what was the date of my most recent trip to the Philippines. And I said 2022. And then they said, you're a member of ICHRP Global, and you work with Justice for Brandon Lee. And I didn't respond to that question. I just looked at them because clearly they knew the answer to these questions. And then after a few more minutes, they said to me, you will not be allowed entry into the Philippines. You have been blacklisted. And at that point, I asked them why. And they said that I was being denied entry because I had participated in a rally against then President Duterte, the People's Sona, in 2016, which actually that reasoning took me by surprise because I had been back to the Philippines three times since 2016. So I asked them to repeat it. I said, why? Why am I not allowed into the country? And they said it was because I had participated in Peace Sona in 2016. At that point, they still had possession of my passport. And without really telling me much of anything, they introduced me to a woman who would be what I call my handler. She was kind of in charge of me for the duration of my time in the airport. So she was responsible for staying with me. And they brought me to another area in the airport where they made me pay. And they put me in a room that was sort of like a dressing room. I don't know if the dressing rooms are the same in Australia, but here the doors don't go all the way up or all the way down. They're just sort of like half doors, so that light and noise could still come in from the outside. And in there was just one bed. And so they put me in this room, and that is where I was to stay for the night. And at this point, I didn't know when I would be leaving. They didn't give me any information. And so I was just put in that room. I was communicating with folks, you know, attorneys and contacts on the outside, and they had just said, you know, be sure not to call anyone. Don't leave your stuff alone because you're still being like watched or monitored. And so during my time in this space, I would take all my stuff with me if I went to the bathroom. There was a shower back there in that area, so I wanted to shower after the long flight from San Francisco. So I did take all my things with me and I did shower. And then around midnight, they came and they pounded on my door and I was laying down and I was like, yes. And they kept pounding until I got up and answered the door. And I don't know really what the point of this visit was, except maybe just to make sure I was still there. I don't know, but people were everywhere. So I couldn't have escaped, you know, asked if I needed anything. And I said, no. And then they told me my flight would be sometime in the morning. But again, they still didn't tell me when, so I didn't have a lot of information about that. I didn't really sleep. I sort of like fell asleep for big bits of maybe 20 minutes at a time and then woke up. And then at like around 6 a.m., I just started getting ready because I didn't know when I would be leaving. I just wanted to be prepared. And so at that point, I went back out and I found the woman who's kind of in charge of me who'd been outside of my door. And I asked her like when we would be leaving. She told me someone would come get me in another 45 minutes. So I just, again, I prepared my things and then finally was informed that my flight would be at 8:40. They came and got me at 7:40. And at that point, they took me out of that area and into a hallway. And we had to wait for more personnel to come because I was actually escorted back to the plane and through security and everything by three people. So there was like three people on either side of me. Still didn't have my passport at this point. So then the three of them rushed me through security, brought me to the front of all of the boarding. So I was one of the first people on the plane. Didn't give me my passport or my boarding pass. So I got on the plane without any of those things, without any information about how I would get my passport back. Was seated on the plane by those folks and then returned to San Francisco. And then when we landed, one of the flight attendants paged me to come and see them before I disembarked, and she gave me back my passport. And she was actually really nice. She apologized. She asked if I was okay. I asked her if they had given her any information as to why I was being deported from the country, and she said no, they wouldn't let her see any of the paperwork either because they never let me read or see any of the paperwork that they had on me. And they had quite a lot of paper. And I could see my picture and stuff on some of the paper, but I couldn't, they didn't ever let me actually read any of it or take copy or write down in the case number or anything. And I was trying to find ways to take a picture. There were so many people around me all the time, and I didn't want to obviously exacerbate or make the situation any more tense. So I didn't want to try to sneak a picture of those documents since they weren't letting me look at them. That was the experience. And then arriving back in the U.S., I had no issue getting through my own immigration.
So you were treated like a criminal?
Yes, very much so.
How did it make you feel?
So on one hand, there have been others in ICHIRP that have been blacklisted. I went prepared for the possibility. There was one sense that I was prepared on some level for to be possibly denied entry. But I was really upset because I was going to the Philippines to go on the fact-finding mission for the Negros 19. And my friend Lyle was one of the victims of that massacre. And so it felt very personal to me to be able to go there, to be able to go to where he was living, where he was staying with people, and to try to find the truth and to be denied for trying to seek the truth and trying to seek justice and do what was right, to do what my faith calls me to do. I'm a pastor, and so I feel compelled to go and be an agent of truth and justice. So I was upset by that. It's upsetting, too, because so many people who are doing criminal acts are allowed to just continue to do them with impunity. And then those who are trying to seek truth and justice are detained and denied. And I felt as though I had failed Lyle and others who I was being sent there to serve.
Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. But why did you go there the first time in 2016? What was the reason?
So in 2016, that was my first trip, and I had just been introduced to some of the human rights violations that were happening in the Philippines. So I became introduced to the Philippines through the California-Nevada Philippine Solidarity Task Force, which is part of the United Methodist Church, in my annual conference. And I actually attended a basketball tournament. So I love basketball, and basketball is very big in the Philippines. And so I participated in this 3-on-3 basketball tournament that they were having. And during that tournament, a group that had just returned from an exposure trip to the Philippines gave a report back. And it was not long after that that there was an incident that happened in the Philippines during a famine, where some of the farmers were protesting, asking for the reserves of rice to be released. And the government, instead of releasing the rice, they opened fire. And they were given shelter on a compound owned by the Methodist Church. And the campaign was rice, not bullets. And I attended a protest in front of the consulate in San Francisco around that campaign where we were chanting rice, not bullets. And it's really where I first started to learn about some of the injustices that happened in the Philippines and that the way the United States was connected and complicit in that. And so in 2016, I had an opportunity to travel with the task force to the Philippines. We went to Mindanao, as I mentioned. I integrated with community in Bukidnon and learned about their conditions around fighting for their land and the way that it has been militarized. And then I actually attended the ICHRP General Assembly that was being held in Mindanao at that time, too. So that was my first trip, was to go and learn about some of the conditions that were happening in the Philippines. And from then on, I just became even more, when I came back, I became more involved with the movement here in the U.S. and the way that, again, our military continues to be complicit. And then it was in 2018 that I was a sponsor. I sponsored Jerome Aba, who was a human rights activist from Mindanao, and he was coming over to the U.S. to speak at Ecumenical Advocacy Days in Washington, D.C. And he was actually detained at SFO by our immigration, and he was tortured and held there for 28 hours. We held a rally in SFO for 28 hours long, our airport of SFO, and it was a 28-hour-long rally where we were fighting and calling for him to be released. And because I was his sponsor, I ended up getting to talk to Jerome on the phone while he was being detained and ended up on the news. And then I went back to the Philippines in 2018 I got to meet up with Jerome in the Philippines, but I also, in 2018, that was when the war on drugs was very at its height. And so in 2018, was in the Metro Manila area going to the homes of those who had lost loved ones in the war on drugs. And so sat in home after home interviewing wives and children and others who've had their loved ones murdered by the state, calling it the war on drugs, and working with an organization called Rise Up. And so that was my second trip. And then, again, just being able to put the connections between the way that the Philippines is still a neo-colony of the U.S. and how migration, 7,000 people leave the Philippines every day because they can't afford to live and survive there. And we're complicit in that. We outsource so much of our labor to the Philippines and we don't pay them living wages. And just became, again, every year, just became more and more engrossed. And it was after that trip that in 2019 I was elected to the general council of ITRIP Global.
You talked about the movement in the United States. What is the movement for the people?
Yeah, so it's like I said, it's just there's a bunch of different organizations. So some of them are, many of them are full of still am. So there's like Malaya, there's Onik Bayan, which is student organizations. There's Bayan. These all have counterparts that are in the Philippines too. Because I'm white, I'm a solidarity ally, so I'm part of ITRIP. But it's these movements of working for justice and liberation for the people of the Philippines, but also because we live in the U.S., what we call the belly of the beast, and so doing that movement for justice and liberation from here and seeing what we can to try to push our own government to stop the funding of military exports in the Philippines until human rights abuses have been accounted for, doing things like that. So that's what I mean by the movement. It's just like the groups of people who are organizing around the Philippines and justice work related to it, and then all of the solidarity that comes along with it.
Talk a little bit more about your last visit there. I think you said 2022.
Yes. So my last trip in 2022 was centered around the election of Marcos. And so in 2022, ITRIP held a bunch of international observers missions where we were sending teams of people over to watch the elections, because we know that fair and just elections are a very important part of the democratic process. And that has not always been the case in the Philippines. And so I was part of one of the teams of people that went there to interview different folks in different regions about their experience around the most recent election of Marcos, and including local elections. It wasn't just about the presidential election, but their experience with the local elections too, and document their experiences and then write those reports and send those reports to the UN. And so I was part of a team. I think there were six of us from the U.S., and we were in the southern Tagalog region interviewing folks in various provinces about their election experiences and staying in the communities themselves to learn about their conditions and some of the hardships they experienced and why the election repression was what it was, based on fights for land and power grabs by the government for land that had been part of communities for hundreds of years, and kind of drawing all those things together. And so we were able to consolidate that information and submit it as big a part of a larger report that was submitted to the United Nations.
As you said, you haven't been back since then, but what reports have you had from your friends there and others who have been able to go about the situation under Marcos?
Yeah, so the situation under Marcos, as far as human rights conditions, it continues to be repressive. Folks continue to be disappeared. Killings and massacres continue to happen. Red tagging is still a huge problem. And so the human rights situation has not improved under Marcos. I think there's this understanding from some folks who aren't as involved that it's different, because it's almost like comparing, like, I don't know how much you know about U.S. politics, but like comparing our Biden to our Trump, right? Where like Trump is brash and he just says like inappropriate things. And that's sort of like Duterte style, right? He just said inappropriate things and was really brash. Where Biden had more respectability. But the policies in many ways are the same. And the same is with Duterte and Marcos, right? Duterte said a lot of off-color, ugly things out loud, but Marcos continues to uphold the policies that Duterte put in place. Like the NTF-LCAT, that's still in place. This looking for people who are speaking out against the government. If you do that, you're at risk of being called a terrorist and red tagged, and your life is at risk. And so the price of goods are at an all-time high over there. And of course, that has global implications as well. But people still can't afford to live. And in Negros, where the massacre happened, that the whole situation over there has to do with hacienda farming and landowners not giving land rights to those who have been farming the lands for years and years. And so all of that continues to be a huge problem under Marcos. And we see that every time there's a typhoon or a natural disaster, we just had this earthquake, where the resources that people need to recover it's just, it exposes all of the infrastructures that are weak and how the government is really just not effective at trying to help them. And then we see Marcos, you know, most recently was trying to get a seat on the UN Security Council. Well, all of this is happening in his own country. So thankfully he lost his bid for that. But
massacres are not an unusual thing, unfortunately, in the Philippines. But this most recent one where 19 people were killed, what do you know about that?
The Negros 19 massacre happened, obviously, in April. And what made it somewhat different is that the government immediately said afterwards that all 19 people were combatants. They were part of the New People's Army. Because there were two PhilAms, Filipino-Americans, amongst those killed, this raised the international attention to a different level, right? My friend Lyle was there. Kai Sarim, who's from Washington State, was also there. And we know that they were not combatants. We know that they're organizers. And then, of course, more news came out about RJ Lacima, who others from here knew, who was a journalist, student, others. There was two minors who were killed. And so quickly it became very clear that the government was trying to cover up the fact that they had violated international humanitarian law in this massacre by killing civilians, by going in and doing strafing, doing this indiscriminate shooting, displacing hundreds of people in the midst of this, and then trying to cover their tracks by, again, this red tagging campaign where they were painting all of those involved as being armed combatants. And so, again, Lyle and Kai and others were there to learn from the peasant farmers, to learn about their conditions, which is why every time I have gone to the Philippines, it's been part of my objective, is to learn from the people who are there. And every single time that I have ever traveled to the Philippines and I've integrated with communities, I've always asked, what can I do to help? And their biggest thing is, like, go and tell our stories. We want the world to know our stories. We want the world to know what's going on. And that's what Lyle, that's what Kai, that's what RJ, who's a journalist, that's what others were doing there. They were learning from those who were fighting for land rights, fighting for dignity and respect against these hacienda big landowners. And for that, and they were rising up, right? They were asserting their rights. And for that, the government in Negros, it's an area where there have been a lot of killings, and several massacres over the years. For that, the military has there's a lot of military operations that happened there. And the Negros 19 was one of those operations. Subsequently, 19 people were killed, and many of them were civilians. And so we're trying to get the word out that just shows, one, the impunity by which the military in the Philippines operates. Because there are international humanitarian law, even though we know there is a civil war that's happening in the Philippines, it doesn't just allow them to go in and just shoot indiscriminately. There are laws that have to be followed, and they did not do that. And instead of trying to account for that, there was mishandling of the bodies. Errol, one of the young men who were killed there, his family didn't even receive the right body. They received someone else. There was a mishandling of those bodies and remains. The autopsy reports show different information than what the military has painted. And so, again, this is happening, and we're able to draw attention to it because it's got international folks, but we know that this happens all the time. Bringing it back to the U.S. connection, the U.S. provides millions, if not billions of dollars in military aid and support. And so we've been actively trying for many years to pass the Philippine Human Rights Act, the PHRA, to stop military aid to the Philippines until we can get an accounting of the human rights violations. Again, we know that the military is shooting indiscriminately, is violating international humanitarian law, which violates our own laws here in the U.S.
Well, they might have stopped you taking part in the fact-finding tour, but others did take part. Where were they from, yes, and were they local or were they internationals as well?
It was both. So there were a handful of others who were international participants. I think there were maybe 5 to 10 that were international participants, not just from the U.S., from other countries as well. And then there was a lot of local participants from all over the Philippines, from different sectors. So it was church people, students, lawyers, journalists, every sector that you can think of. And they really sent, I think they sent like almost 100 people to Negros from all of these different backgrounds to meet with people, to go to the area where the massacre happened, to look at the forensics, to interview locals who were there, who experienced it firsthand, who knew Lyle and Kai and Errol and RJ and Maureen and all of the other victims. So yeah, they had a very successful fact-finding mission. We've had some initial reports, and I know that the finalized report should be out sometime soon.
And where will that report go? Who gets it?
It'll go to the Commission on Human Rights in the Philippines, of course, as we always. I believe the Commission on Human Rights has opened up their own investigation. We always send copies of reports to the UN, and it'll go to other international bodies. I know that we will send copies to our legislators here in the U.S. Again, we've had some meetings with some of our legislative officers as we try to get them to bring more accountability and attention to this massacre. And again, as we continue to try to stop U.S. military aid from being sent to the Philippines.
It goes on and on and on. But the other issue you were challenged on at the airport was the case of Brandon Lee. Can you tell us about Brandon?
Brandon is now back in San Francisco, but Brandon is a San Francisco native. He's Chinese American. And he and Lyle actually both met each other at San Francisco State, where they both became involved in organizing around the Philippines when they were young adults, 18, 19 years old. When Brandon was a young adult, he decided that he was going to move to the Philippines to work with the people. So he ended up moving to the Cordillera region of the Philippines, which is the northernmost part, one of the northernmost part of the top island. And he lived there for almost 10 years. He married a woman from there. He had a daughter with the woman from there. He worked as a paralegal and a reporter and integrated with the indigenous communities and their fight for land and rights. And for that, many in the region, the Cordillera region, many of his colleagues and co-workers were red tagged. He lost others who were assassinated. But in August of 2019, Brandon was the target of an assassination attempt, and he was shot 4 times outside of his home while he went outside to feed his dogs. He was taken by his brother-in-law at the time to the nearest hospital and then transferred over to Baguio, where he suffered 8 cardiac arrests and is now paralyzed. He's a quadriplegic. It took international attention, and I actually went to the Philippines in 2019 as part of a fact-finding mission to visit Brandon in the hospital and also learn more about his case as well in 2019. So that was my other trip to the Philippines, was right after his assassination attempt. And then we worked very hard to get Brandon medevaced back to the United States after that attempt, where he's now been living since 2019 and continues to organize. He's part of ICHRP US and continues to speak out not only about his case, but for all of those who have been targeted by the Philippines government for standing with the indigenous, for speaking out about human rights. And again, his case, he was one of the first, I think he might have been the first US citizen who was targeted for the work, which is why his case was notable. And so, yes, I've done a lot of work with him in meeting with legislators and meeting with the Commission on Human Rights in the Philippines, trying to get justice for him and for his case that has been archived. And Brandon continues to be a very vocal, outspoken person around the rights of people in the Philippines and also the rights of those who have been killed, who can't speak for themselves. So not only do we speak about justice for Brandon Lee, we talk about justice for Brandon Lee and for all martyrs and victims of the Philippines who have been killed for just trying to assert human rights.
Where is his wife and child?
They're also here in the U.S. now. They were able to join him over here.
And it all stems back to the U.S. Well, you could say control of the Philippines, couldn't you? And increasingly because of their belligerence against China.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we see continued allyship happening between our governments too, which is concerning as the Philippines opens up more ways for joint military exercises and the Balikpapan exercises that happen every year. And so instead of being worried about what's happening to everyday people, right, they're joining military forces and they're joining It's exactly because of this fear about China. And as a result, people and people's lives are almost like this collateral damage that they don't seem to care very much about.
Well, focus on you for a moment, Sadie. What is life for you now? You're back home.
Yes, just graduated from law school. So in addition to serving as the full-time United Methodist pastor, I graduated from law school about a week after my blacklisting. And so now I am studying for the California bar exam, which I will take next month. Really, my focus is just to continue to serve the people in all the ways that I can, to continue to speak out, to promote and fight for justice for the Negros 19, to keep using my platform as a pastor, hopefully soon as an attorney, to keep promoting and working towards justice for all people around the globe.
A busy life.
Yes. Yes, very much.
Thank you so much, Sadie, for talking to me today.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time and being interested in the story and the Negros 19 especially. We really want to amplify what has happened with them and the continued repression, right, that the Philippines is afraid of the truth.
I've been speaking with the Reverend Sadie Stone, a United Methodist pastor, a member of the Global Council of the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Dr. Tim Anderson has been absent for Australia for a couple of months. He's been in Iran and Cuba. Today we're going to talk about his time in Iran. And I asked him first, was he there at the beginning of the war by Trump and Netanyahu on Iran?
There was a small group of four of us that went into Iran overland from the north in March. So we entered about the 19th, I think, of March, about a bit over 2 weeks after the war had begun. And we arrived at Manab School 4 weeks after the US had bombed that school.
What was left of it?
Well, it was rubble. The school was rubble. We went to the graveyard, actually, to see all of the parents who were really camped out there, still mourning. They'd been mourning all that time, all that 4 weeks. And we went to the house of some of the children who were killed, of the family, and then to the graveyard. Then we went to the school to see the rubble and look through the rubble and see what was surrounding the school, basically.
And how many children, and I'd imagine teachers as well, died that time?
The iconic number is 168, but that was an initial figure which included the 26 teachers and the school children, who were mainly schoolgirls but also school boys. So the number has been a little bit, and it includes a few different groups. There were 26 teachers, mostly fairly young women, and the rest were school children, mainly girls, but there was a boys' school there too. So, and there were some other schools and other school children attacked that we saw as we were travelling through. But 168 has become this iconic number that is now being commemorated around the world, basically. The Iranian athletes, when they compete, are always, and the negotiating team that went to Pakistan, they're all carrying little backpacks and the number 168.
It's shades of Palestine, isn't it, with the children being targeted?
Yeah, it's very like that, in the sense that the people and their civilization have been declared something that the imperial enemy wants to eliminate, basically. They don't make any distinction. In fact, the fact that the Minab school and some other targets were The first targets of this war on February the 28th this year shows that there was careful planning about the attack on children. It wasn't an accident, it wasn't a mistake, as some people have been saying. There's a counter-intel, a counter-terrorism woman in the US who says that their intelligence would have been very good on that school, and there was real-time video on the Tomahawk missiles they used to incinerate the children there and carry out the double or triple tap strike there. In fact, after we left the school there at the end of March, the school was bombed again for some reason. A couple of sites we were at were bombed again. You know, who knows why, really, because there was nothing much left there to destroy. The same with a meteorological station in Bushehr. Either they were chasing us, or there's some sort of deterrence for people to go and examine those sorts of sites. But anyway, we managed to get in and get out safely to examine a number of the places that were bombed by the US and the Israelis.
What do you mean that you mightn't have been safe there?
Maybe that they were trying to target witnesses who were going in to see the results, because there were some rumours spread about the Iranians had done it themselves, or that there was some military base there, one thing or another. We looked at the adjacent buildings in the Manab school to see if there was any other sort of operations there, because the school site itself had been a military base some 20 years ago. That school was created 13 years ago, and it was before that it was also used for some health department facilities. You know, there were some remnants of pharmaceutical items in there that we saw, but basically to dispel any sorts of rumours. So I think they may have been chasing, of course, you know, they've been chasing journalists in Gaza and in Lebanon too, you know, so it wouldn't be surprising if they had been chasing us too.
Well, as observers, where did your results go to?
We were all self-publishing, basically. I mean, there was one Turkish journalist who's got quite a big following in Turkey, and one North American / Iraqi guy, and one Greek Canadian guy, and me. And I was the one non-journalist, but you know, I'm a writer, I'm a observer, I'm an analyst. Dimitri Laskaris, for example, the Greek Canadian, he publishes his own. Him and Ahmed from the US were mainly YouTubers. They were publishing videos. They were editing videos as we were traveling around and publishing them in that sort of way. And then we were all being interviewed by different media outlets at that time, in particular, I suppose, when we were in the Straits of Hormuz, when they began to talk about the control of the Straits of Hormuz at the end of March.
What was it like there?
Well, very calm in many ways, but it's strange because the whole war on Iran is not a normal war, as many Iranian people themselves are pointing out to us. You know, there's no front lines, there isn't a guerrilla war like in Palestine. You haven't got a normal sort of war. You have everyday life in what's rather a big country with very large cities, and then you have these repeated regular type of terrorist attacks, bombings of sites, which are for the most part civilians, the ones that we saw basically. You know, we saw many hospitals, we saw many civilian sites, school children, families attacked, post office workers. A woman at one of the rallies there was killed. There was a residential area in Tehran, Resalat, we visited that had been bombed, and many people had been killed, and there was nothing, there was no military or any sort of other strategic site there. There was a police station, and with all next door, the bakery and residential areas and a cafe across the road. So we were looking at all of these sites that had been bombed, and we were publishing it in different ways. And then, of course, seeing the people rallying in Iran, not as the Netanyahus of the world had said that, you know, the people were ready to rise up against this regime and overthrow it. Rather, they rallied behind their military, they rallied behind their flag. They're still doing it more than 100 days after this war in Iran. That was an extraordinary thing to see.
What was it like travelling around from probably town to town to city and seeing the damage? How does it impact on you?
Well, it's like I said, seeing the people rallying out in the open every night during this war was quite extraordinary, really. You know, you normally expect to see, and you do see, people fleeing from war. You know, all the refugees from Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria that fled through Turkey into Europe, you know, it's very common to see people fleeing a war. But in this case, they were coming back from Turkey, from Europe, the same route that we followed, the overland route through Turkey into northern Iran, and then down through the northern cities through to Tehran and the other cities. So it was extraordinary, really, but also we were seeing all of these very personalized tragedies, you know, the families, meeting with the families of people who'd been murdered, and that they had there was no real reason why. Why would they attack a post office worker in Tabriz? You know, why? Okay, they attacked military people. We went to the funeral of an Iranian colonel in Isfahan, but they waited till he went home so they could murder his whole family, except for one of his children who we visited in hospital, you know. So we kept seeing these personal tragedies and how people were facing it. And of course, they were angry. Of course, they wanted justice. They wanted revenge. And there were all these people rallying. And every night they were out on the streets and making themselves vulnerable, of course, because some of those rallies, like the Palestine rally, the Quds Day rally at the end of Ramadan there, that was targeted by a drone too. And there was one woman killed there, you know. So people make themselves vulnerable, but they were deliberately putting themselves out in the open there to make themselves a type of human shield, a type of moral support for their military defending their country.
And of course, they've seen it all before, time and again, being attacked.
They have, but as the bakery owner told us in Niloufar Square in Tehran, this is not a normal war. He was in the Iran-Iraq war, that man. The Iran-Iraq war was a conventional sort of war with two sides, you know, and terrible things were happening, but it was a war as you expect to see it, whereas there was something surreal about this. I have some very strong images in my mind of, for example, being Isfahan, which is a beautiful city, and I've been there before, but being in the middle of Shah Abbas' palace and the square there, seeing all the children playing in the rain and the sun showers at that time, because the drought broke when we were there. That was another feature of our visit. We were there when some big rains began to come across the whole region. You see people going about their normal lives happily in tranquility, and then in the distance you see a plume of smoke where there's been another missile attack, basically. So this is the nature of the war. It's a very unusual sort of war.
Is there a lot of propaganda on the streets of Tehran or Iran itself from Israel and America?
No, there's nothing from the Israelis and from the US on the streets there. There aren't people rallying in support of the bombing attack on Iran. Although outside Iran, you've got these expat Iranians, you know, typically monarchists and Zionists who are celebrating the bombing of their own people, which is extraordinary. But inside Iran, of course, you have a lot of official lined slogans and caricatures of the monsters that are attacking them. And in Shiraz, for example, the mayor who we spoke to there, they'd set up a display with the remains of a mangled public bus showing one of the targets that the Israelis or the US had hit in Shiraz, and then a big billboard with Trump's image and details from the Iranian Red Crescent to say that at that time, when we were in Shiraz, 85,000 civilian sites had been hit by these Israelis and by the US, basically. Sometimes they knew exactly where the missile was coming from. We visited a young sportsman, a 12-year-old soccer player in hospital in Shiraz, and he had been struck on sports fields down to the south and brought to the Shiraz hospital. Everyone knew, they'd been told that this missile came from Bahrain. So it came from, Bahrain is the site of the big naval base, what used to be a big US naval base is now virtually destroyed by Iranian missiles. But in some cases, they know where these missiles are coming from. Of course, the Tomahawk missiles came from a particular ship many hundreds of kilometers south of Iran, not even in the Persian Gulf. So in some cases, they know where these attacks are coming from. In some cases, they don't.
What I meant was propaganda on the streets. And I think it was January when we last spoke about Iran. You spoke about the agents of Israel who were instigating a lot of the violence late last year, where many people were killed. That wasn't happening this time.
No, there was no rallies against the government on the streets at that time. You're talking about in January. It was, I think, the 8th and the 8th and the 9th of January, early this year. What happened late last year, there were these rallies against the economic crisis and the collapse of the value of the currency that went on for about 10 days. And then on the 8th, I think it was the 8th and 9th of January, they were infiltrated by these agents with armed people acting for the Israelis and for the US, carrying out these attacks on the civilians themselves and on the police and some of the volunteers who were supporting the state, basically. None of that. So there was no rallying of Mossad or CIA agents on the streets. You know, they would have been in great danger or would have been arrested if they'd tried that, really, because, as I said, there was this huge counter rally, you know, in support of the government, in support of the military.
You made the comparison between what is still happening to the children of Palestine and the children of Iran. What about hospital workers, health workers, and journalists?
Yeah, well, we know the health workers and the journalists have been specific targets in Palestine and in South Lebanon, where this war is still going on. It's the same war in my view. I've always been of view there's a single war going on in West Asia, the so-called Middle East, which is all linked in, which is why you also see now when the so-called negotiations involve commitments from the US to try and rein in the Israelis in their attacks on Lebanon there. So in Iran, though, it's rather different because, as I said, we were concerned when we were down in Minab. When we returned to Bandar Abbas from Minab, actually, we had a scare when we heard that there'd been a drone attack on the Minab school. And so we immediately got out of our bus and moved into private taxis, basically, to go back to Bandar Abbas, because there was a suspicion, I'm not sure if it was true, suspicion that we might have been hunted by the Mossad, by the Israelis or by the US, basically. There was some suspicion that we might have been tracked ourselves. There were a few other foreign journalists in Iran at the time, but we were the ones who were going to these sites that had just been recently bombed. We feared that there may have been an attempt to try and assassinate us, but in terms of the Iranian journalists, there certainly were deliberate attacks on the media centres. That included, by the way, in one of the hospitals. We visited a couple of hospitals, one in Bushehr, which had been seriously damaged by bombing attacks around the hospital, so shockwaves around the hospital. That hospital, the Persian Gulf Martyrs Hospital in Bushehr, had been evacuated over a period of time because of these, what may have been collateral damage from attacks around the hospital. And then it was certainly the case in Tehran. The Gandhi Hospital was almost completely destroyed by serious shockwaves from attacks on the media center across the road. There's one of the centers of the Iranian public media is just across the road from the Gandhi Hospital. Fortunately, no one was killed in the Gandhi Hospital. In the media center, I'm not sure who was killed there. So there was, as there was in the June, the 12-day war last year, there were deliberate attacks on Iranian media, you know, which the West loves to call state media, as though that doesn't exist anywhere else. There were certainly missile attacks on Iranian media, no doubt casualties in some of those centres.
Can you talk a bit about the Straits of Hormuz, the history of it? And we know it's why it's been in the news, but in recent times or other times, this has never been the focus of the wars.
No, that's right. And of course, there was no security regulation of the Hormuz Straits before this recent war, the one that began on 28th of February. Hormuz is a few islands down there. It's about the opening and the entry to and the opening of the Persian Gulf is really only about 20 miles wide, something like that. But the shipping passage is narrower than that. It passes between three Iranian islands close to Bandar Abbas, the big southern city down there. And so that's the deeper water that the shipping, the big tankers and so on come through. So that has been the access point to the Persian Gulf, which provides about, I think it's 20% of the world's oil and gas. And also petrochemicals like fertilizer, for example, which there are some outlets from, at least from Saudi Arabia into the Red Sea, but most of the oil and gas from the Persian Gulf monarchies and Iran itself go through those straits. And it's been largely unregulated up until now. But of course, as a result of the war and as a result of enemy shipping or enemy allied shipping, the Iranians decided to regulate it in the first place. Everyone talks about there being a toll there. But there's a selective toll on some of those Arab regimes there, depending on the extent to which they're allied with the US. The Iranians are particularly concerned, and why they began to regulate the passage there and in some cases charge a toll was because, of course, they were being attacked directly by the Israelis and by the US. And there were a number of these Arab regimes had bases, were hosts to bases that were being used, like Bahrain, like Qatar, which has the main military headquarters, had the main military headquarters of the US. I believe the war is now being managed from the continental US itself. But the so-called CENTCOM, the branch of the Pentagon for West Asia, for the so-called Middle East, has been in Qatar, Al Ubaid Air Base, and then the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain. And then the Emirates had a number of at least two US bases, one Australian base, I believe, one naval base at Jabal Ali port. Almost all of these Persian Gulf Arab regimes, which are all family dictatorships basically, minus Oman, which has maintained a type of a neutral position for many, many years, although it's part of the Gulf Council Cooperation Group as well. But they've all really been hosting US military facilities, which have been used against Iran. And now, as a result of this war, those facilities are completely or partially destroyed. They no longer function as military facilities, although just recently there were some attacks on the naval base there. There's the remnants of some US occupation in Bahrain, and I think in Kuwait to a certain extent too. And perhaps in the hiding in the hotels in Dubai, in the Emirates, there are still military personnel there. But basically, their air bases, their military bases, their radar in particular, are used to target sites in Iran have been mostly destroyed. So that's one effect of the war. And the Iranians had this planned, and they spoke about it a long time in advance. And what they hadn't spoken about, and what people didn't really perhaps properly anticipate, was that Iran was going to impose this security regulation on shipping passing through the straits, because they didn't want enemy shipping to be using their territorial waters to then provide supply to those bases. So that's been the point of contention. It's a regulation that didn't exist before the war. It's more or less an advantage, a control point that the Iranians asserted as a result of the war, and they didn't use before the war, basically. And now the US is not in a position to retake it from Iran because it's so closely linked to Iranian territory. And the Iranians, through their land-based and water-based military, are able to assert control. You would notice, anyone observing closely would notice, that none of the mighty US Navy ships have even got within hundreds of kilometers of the Persian Gulf, because they're so worried about the prospect of being hit by anti-ship missiles or medium-range missiles that are all along the hilly and mountainous lands of Iran that fringe that northern part of the Persian Gulf there. There's been no possibility of any ground invasion or naval invasion of that area, and so effectively the Iranians have gained control of the Straits of Hormuz, and they're not giving it up. And however much Trump screams and shouts and bombs, he isn't able to change that fact. Most of the Asian countries that got their fuel through the Persian Gulf, and at least some of the European countries, are actually now talking normally to the Iranians and getting a security clearance from the Iranian security forces. And then that security clearance from the Iranian security forces is recognized now by the shipping insurance companies, which is one of these strange sort of ironies or contradictions, because, of course, the Anglo-Americans control still the financial world, if they don't control commerce and production and technology, but they do dominate the financial world. But nevertheless, companies like Lloyd's of London, for example, recognize a security clearance from Iran, which has the effect of reducing the insurance premiums on shippings passing through the Persian Gulf, and effectively allows them to get insurance and passage through the Straits of Hormuz there. So the Iranians have effectively secured Anglo-American finance to support for insurance, which makes viable the passage of big ships through the Straits of Hormuz now.
Again, is this the first time that Iran has attacked the Gulf states where the US facilities are?
Yes, it is. It is. They've spoken about it. They threatened it before, of course, because they knew that these US facilities in the Persian Gulf were aimed at them. But they hadn't moved against them, and they tried to encourage their neighbours, you know, their Arab regime neighbours, the Saudis, the Emiratis and Qatar and so on, that, you know, they should not engage themselves in hostile activities against Iran. Because, of course, some of their neighbours have productive relations. You know, Qatar has some joint ventures in gas with Iran, and its economic future, you would think, in a rational sense, should be tied to Iran rather than with a power on the other side of the world, which is trying to damage and destroy the influence of Iran in the region. So, of course, there's some serious soul searching going on in those Arab regimes now in the Persian Gulf about what they're going to do in the future. Are they going to allow the US to come back in and rebuild military facilities, which are not going to be able to protect? This is one thing that the war has demonstrated, that the US has not been there to protect Qatar or Kuwait or Bahrain or Saudi Arabia. The US has put all its efforts into trying to help protect the Israelis from the retaliation by the Iranians. It hasn't worked in the way that some of those monarchies had hoped that hosting these bases might work. It would provide some protection for them. Clearly, it didn't do that.
To go back to the people of Iran, how are they coping with these sanctions?
Well, there are shortages. It's not as extreme as Cuba, which we may talk about later on. But certainly, you know, there's been the US has succeeded in devaluing the Iranian currency. Nevertheless, during the war, there's been a renewal of some of the sale of Iranian fuel. And Iranian fuel, of course, it's very well known that much of Chinese shipping has passed through Trump's so-called blockade. Trump hasn't been willing to confront Chinese shipping coming out of the Persian Gulf and some other shipping, for example, to Indonesia, to Bangladesh, to Malaysia, I believe, has been passing through. France has had some ships passing through there too. So Iran has been allowing a lot of that shipping through, and the US hasn't blocked some of that sort of shipping. And on top of that, you have now a rail link from Iran through to China and through to Pakistan and some other countries, Central Asian countries, which didn't exist before. That's been in place for about a year, and it started to work too. So, of course, China has relied on building these Belt and Road infrastructure, the rail links and road links over land, to evade the attempts by the US to blockade it by sea, because even now the US is trying, to some extent with the support of its new naval base in Western Australia, to try and contain the shipping to China through the Straits of Malacca, for example. So the US is trying to proceed with its futile attempt to try and block the trade that China has by the sea. So the land routes and the rail routes have been one way that China is using to avoid that type of blockade there. So overall, you know, the Iranian economy has suffered under the unilateral coercive measures that have been imposed on it by the US and by the Europeans. But they've been experiencing that for some decades now, and it actually hasn't worsened a lot. There are some shortages of things in Iran, but Iran is a big country which provides, for example, it does trade in basic commodities, but it grows most of its own food, it produces most of its own clothes, even motor vehicles and things like that. Iran, a big country like that, the impact of US unilateral sanctions is not the same as it is in little countries like Cuba, for example, or Nicaragua. But big countries like Russia and China and Iran, it affects their commerce, it affects their economy, but it doesn't really block the supply of basic goods which they produce themselves.
You always said that the US is not going to find Iran a pushover like they have with other Middle Eastern countries when they attack them. What has this war that they started done to the role of the US now in the world?
Well, it's a very important question because, of course, the world has been watching the US fail in its attempt to subjugate Iran. And, of course, that includes not just its big rivals, Russia and China, who are targeted from time to time in different ways, but also its so-called allies, like the Europeans, who have not all been entirely happy with the way in which the US has been dominating the European bloc, the Japanese, the Koreans, who in normal circumstances, for example, South Korea and Japan, which are occupied by US military forces, have been very compliant to the US, but they also, in better circumstances, would rather have a good normal commercial relationship with Iran. For example, you may recall there was a lot of Iranian funds frozen for many years in South Korea, which were unfrozen last year. But Korea has its own big petrochemical industry, which is very, very much like to have supply of the light fuel that comes from Iran rather than the heavy fuel that comes from some other parts of the world. For example, the Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Bahrain and Kuwait and so on have to be rethinking their relationship with the US because it hasn't provided security for them. And why shouldn't they have a good relationship and productive commercial relationship with Iran? And a similar sort of thing is passing through the minds of most of the Asian countries that have had this now, this ambiguity in their relationship with the US. Clearly, the idea of US military supremacy and being able to do whatever it likes in the world, and I suppose the lesson also of Venezuela, where clearly there was something exceptional that happened in Venezuela, some type of betrayal of their principles in the sense that the Venezuela is now prohibited from complying with its obligations to China. China provided a lot of credit to Venezuela, and in return it was getting Venezuelan oil. That's been blocked now. Cuba still has medical missions in Venezuela, but they're not being compensated per the contract. Just the individual doctors are being paid some sort of salary. Venezuela has been compromised in many ways by that operation, which is the sort of operation that Trump likes, a short, quick victory where he can walk away and strut around like a rooster and crow that he's taken over control of Venezuelan oil and so on. He would have liked to do that with Iran. He thought perhaps he was fooled by the Israelis into thinking that Iran was going to be a pushover. He maybe thinks he can do it again with Cuba. Basically, the image of the US and the world has been damaged very seriously, and many, many countries are rethinking, to what extent they are going to be intimidated by or subordinated by. I mean, many of the Southeast Asian countries, for example, they weren't subject to economic unilateral sanctions in a way that other countries were, but they were very keen to find some alternative to the US dollar, the dictatorship of the dollar and the SWIFT system, which has blocked them from having normal relations with other countries. As I said, South Korea was told they couldn't purchase Iranian oil. Lots of countries have been told they can't trade with countries under unilateral sanctions by the US. So most of the world is rethinking that now. The Europeans, of course, were told, and they complied really with this edict that they shouldn't be buying oil and gas from Russia. No, maybe that's up in the air again now.
Dr. Tim Anderson speaking about his recent time in Iran. And on the program next week, we'll hear about what life is like for the people of Cuba.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Make your donation during our annual Radiothon and help us celebrate 50 years on air.
Donate to the 3CR Radiothon fundraiser this June.
To donate, call 0394198377 or go online at 3cr.org.au.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
the incubators of Woodstock, and closer to home, Nimbin. Those who marched in the moratoriums, hippies, who the establishment feared would pull down the whole sacred edifice of capital and progress, the whole countercultural milieu. Those wild days of the 60s and 70s, why have we, of that generation, become for the most part such conservative, boring old farts? That's the opening paragraph of an article by historian, musician, theologian, social commentator John Kruepel, published recently in Pearls and Irritations. What happened to the baby boomers generation? When we spoke, I reminded John of the song written in 1955 by Pete Seeger, "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" and asked him if that was an apt example.
Oh, look, can't go wrong with Pete Seeger. He lived to be a ripe old age, 95, about 10 years ago, I think. But he wrote a lot of those songs that people think are just anonymous or don't know where they're written, but "Where Are All the Flowers Gone?" "We Shall Overcome." Oh, a lot of those songs, they escape me at the moment. But fantastic writer. And he was a icon of the sort of radical movement, I guess, Pete Seeger and Springsteen and Dylan. They were all influenced by Pete Seeger.
Where do these songs fit in with the way you're feeling at the moment?
I always go back to those songs. I perform them too. I've even recorded, not those songs, but other songs. They're collector's items because only collectors ever got them. No one else did. Yeah, look, those songs are always a great encouragement, and they're sing-along songs. I know Pete Seeger always wanted people to sing along and join in. And I was at a do not long ago, actually, and I was singing, and most of the audience were about 18 to 25, I guess. And I said, "Oh my God, this is exactly the same sort of thing that happened at a coffee houses and that sort of thing back in the 70s. So it was like going back in time.
So where do you see it now, John?
Oh, look, the young ones seem to be much more hopeful, but, you know, you hope that they end up like so conservative like ones of my age have become.
Let's go back to what it was like for you when you were 18, 19. What was it like?
Probably I wasn't that radical. I wasn't involved in the moratorium and that sort of thing. I was at high school. There were a few that were. They were probably more politically aware than I was at 17 or 18. Most of us are not that politically aware at that age, is why they recruit those sort of age people, because they don't really understand that much. And any 17 or 18 year olds listening, they're probably an exception to the rule, but I wasn't. But it was a time, you know, in the 70s, of sort of coffee houses and the folk musicians, folk revival. There was a lot of rock music happening. It was a time of people heading up to Nimbin, and of course they'd had Woodstock in the US in 69, and that was the last months of that decade. Then Nimbin here was 1973. The moratoriums were 1970, I think. So it was a time of ferment and excitement, and some really hoped they were creating a new world. The ones that headed up to Nimbin certainly were hoping they were creating a new world, as university students and others from the Australian University students, AUS. It was a time of ferment. It was a change, and it was probably quite a radical change from the generation before. My generation, that are now gone or very aged, were much more. It was a liberation time, I guess. A lot of us broke free of the bonds of the traditional suburban sort of society, but I don't know what's happened to that.
Why did it happen at that time?
The Vietnam War had a lot to do with it. It was a hangover. Everyone at my age, I was just a bit too young, but you had the lottery. The marbles were drawn out for conscription, and that hung over everyone. And most people did go, of course, or they went to into the army. There was actually is a myth of all the ones that got away from conscription. There was about 1.5% actually avoided conscription by heading up country or somewhere. You could probably do it in those days. Hard to chase and trace people down. But it, I think the Vietnam War was probably the main stimulus to that whole time and the rejection of that. And that was very strong in Australia and, of course, in the United States. So that was the ferment, I think.
Do you say you were just on the fringes?
Yeah, I was a bit too young. I'm 70, just turning 72 now. So normally the ones I went to Vietnam or about 74. I was asked a few times, did I go to Woodstock? I said, yeah, I was 15. I said, goodbye, Mum and Dad. I'm flying over the United States, upstate New York. Although when I went there one stage, I got lost. I asked someone, I looked at them, they said, you know what I'm looking for, don't you? And she said, oh, yeah, we know. Woodstock, that way.
Well, where did you end up?
My radicalisation, I've tended to get more radical, I think, as I've got older. And I touched on that in my writing. Like, what are we hanging on to? It's a bit silly us hanging on because it's unlikely that I'll be hanging on to too much stuff, too much old. I'm not planning on dying yet, but it is on the horizon. So what am I going to hang on to? I really should be getting to a point of deep thinking and questioning, and we really should be moving beyond this hanging on to things. Maslow wasn't it, who had this idea of self-actualizing. We move past our needs for security, food, security, relationship. Most of us have got all those things. At my age, we should be really self-actualizing. And I think it was Carl Jung who said every question in the second part of your life has a sort of spiritual basis, meaning in a wider sense of existential, what's the meaning and purpose of things. This is what we should be doing, what we're trying to hang on to, what can't be hung on to too much longer.
Yet you write that gone are the idealistic young rebels, burning with zeal, ready to change the world.
Yeah, I think a lot of us were, and then we can romanticise things and look back with rose-tinted glasses, but probably most of us were concerned. But there was that ferment. People talk about the 60s and the 70s, and that old line, if you can remember them, you weren't there, sort of thing. But it was that age, that breaking through. Of course, a lot of it ended up tragic. The whole drug culture and this sort of thing ended up tragic. But in those days, it was an exciting sort of thing. Turn on, tune in, and drop out sort of thing. Timothy Leary and these sort of figures. And that ended up a lot of ways tragic. But we weren't to know that at the time. But I guess we're going to hang on to hope, because I think the young ones on the surveys that I've been, tend to be much more questioning the post-millennials, much more questioning than the baby boomers and the X, Ys and Zs they talk about these days.
Well, you mentioned a number of musicians and singers from that era. How influential do you believe they were?
I think they were very influential. Every record collection, because they were records in those days, had those people in it. Dylan, Joan Baez, Simon Garfunkel, Cat Stevens, Rodriguez. I'm talking about Joni Mitchell, John Lennon, Melanie and others. I'm talking about the ones that were, the lyrics were the thing. They were really, in a sense, writing poetry. When you look at the work of someone like Rodriguez in particular, it's poetry in itself, or some of Dylan's stuff is poetry in itself. The music is almost like an incidental extra. These were lyricists that were questioning things, and those musicians were got to the top 40 on commercial radio. I don't think musicians who would be maybe battling to get on to that. I'm not saying they're not around, and I listen to a lot of young people's music that they're creating, but it's not that much of it gets on to into the commercial mainstream these days.
Well, let's look at the younger generation. Who are they, and who are the influences on them?
On I'm going to show my generational age here, I guess. Look, I think there's a lot of questioning, a lot of ecological questioning, because I'm in Newcastle, the rising tide come here every November and have the protest, because Newcastle's the world's largest cult. So there's a lot of questioning around ecological issues. Those issues probably weren't as important in my day, because they maybe weren't as pressing, although Nimbin certainly was a dropping out to the idealised rural environment. But there's a lot of questioning around environmental issues, and there's a whole spirituality behind that, talking in the broader sense of what that word can mean. So I think the environment is a crucial thing, but a lot more realising also, and you can see that in the polls, that there's a high vote for the Greens by young people, the very low vote for One Nation, which is the obverse to what my generation is, unfortunately. But there's a lot of that sort of questioning, and questioning the economics of modern society and the consumerism of modern society, the sort of things that we did question, I have to say. But hopefully theirs is a more radical questioning than ours was.
And when you see the people on the streets and questioning the role of Israel and the United States in the world today, a lot of those protesting and activating are young people.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it always makes me feel good, in the sense that maybe I can retire from protesting. I no doubt will at one stage. I know that some keep going to their 90s protesting. I know that depends on health and that sort of thing. But it's good to know that you're not the last grouping, that there's others to carry on the struggle. And that's a great thing. I always enjoy seeing young people there, and they're very accepting of the old parts, like myself being there. That's really, really great. So it's fantastic, the generational carry on of these radical causes, these causes for justice and peace and equality and all those sorts of things.
And the influence of new media.
Yeah, new media is a huge thing. No such thing in my day, of course. You rang up someone. That was about the extent of the technology. Now there's huge amounts of new media and alternative media in terms of reading. You know, there's community radio, for instance, we're on now. I may be wrong, you may correct me, is a big stretch back to about the 70s or 80s.
1976.
1976. That was the first of the alternative media. Now, of course, there's alternative media everywhere. There's different journals one can subscribe to. There's things you can just turn on the computer, and the algorithm normally establishes your direction you're going in. And there's problems with that, obviously, but you'll find something that comes up, that looks interesting, I'll read that article, or I'll look at that clip on YouTube or whatever. So media has become and much more important, and it's threatening the old style media, because when I grew up there was just the newspapers and the TV, and now there's all of these alternatives, and that creates some problems in itself, because a lot of it's not terribly credible. But when you find the credible sites and places to look online, there's some fascinating stuff and educational stuff. So that's great. And young people, of course, have far more about this than I do, and use that new media incredibly creatively.
Well, finally, John, I started off with Pete Seeger. If Pete was alive today, what do you think he'd make of the world?
But I think he might have died at the right time. He died only a couple of years before Trump 1 came along, the first edition of Trump. I think he'd be horrified what's happening in the US now. But I'm sure at 105 he'd be, I think. He'd still be out there protesting, and he'd still be writing songs of struggle and creative input into protest movement, still be there, and we'd still be overcoming.
And I'm sure you'll still be there at 105, John.
Oh, good luck to me.
Thanks to John Quirapel.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.